Welcome to Radio at Firehouse.com. Real issues, real answers, real firefighters. Firehouse.com brings you the leaders of the nation's fire, rescue, and EMS services, the top columnists and educators, and today's most important issues, headlines, and comments. Listen right on your desktop or download and listen on the go to Firehouse.com.
Hello and welcome to the Leader's Toolbox on Firehouse.com. I'm Rich Gasway and I'm the host of the Leader's Toolbox. We're in Dallas, Texas at Fire Rescue International, and I am pleased to have a special guest with me today, Steve Austin, who is the project manager for the Emergency Responder Safety Institute. Steve has been in the fire service an unprecedented 46 years, serving in Virginia, West Virginia, and Delaware. And today we are going to be talking about the work of the Emergency Responder Safety Institute. Steve, the obvious jumping off point is, what is the Emergency Responder Safety Institute?
Well, Chief, first, good to be with you today, and thanks for having me. I guess we used to talk about the old guys. I guess I'm one of them now. I've been around a little while. But we're part of the Cumberland Valley Volunteer Firearms Association. We're now on our 109th year of service as a mutual aid association organized in the Mid-Atlantic area. And about 11 years ago, one of our members was tragically struck and killed at a highway incident scene in Western Maryland. And as a result of that, a number of us were at the funeral and the wake and had a discussion about, is this all there is, or are we going to do something about this issue? And sometimes that's the best way to start out, at square one and begin talking about what we can do to prevent this kind of incident happening in the future. As a result, a number of us went to work. We reached out to the broader public safety community, and for the last 11 years, we have been in the forefront of dealing with the what happens when you set your parking brake and step out onto the hard surface, onto that macadam, which we believe is the second most dangerous place in the fire service, and also a very dangerous place for all responders who are on the highways responding to help others who are in need. We don't want to become part of the problem there, and we certainly don't want to be part of a secondary incident. But unfortunately, Rich, that's what injures and takes the lives of many of our brothers and sisters every year.
Well, I applaud the Institute for being compelled to action based on something that happened to one of your members. And, you know, it's often said, does somebody have to die before things will change? And in this case, tragically, somebody did, but at least it spawned the creation of the Institute and has created opportunities to educate first responders and to hopefully make them safer when they're out on highway incidents. Talk a little bit about why the work that you do with the Institute is so important for public safety responders.
The core of what we do is to address the issue of safety for responders. But in looking at that whole problem, we're faced with a challenge that that we haven't seen in the past. I don't care where you go in this country, there's going to be somebody that recognizes that traffic is becoming a larger and larger problem in the community. And moving traffic and working around moving traffic is a real challenge for us. Before, we could bring an engine out to the scene and we could park it, and generally people would see the lights, would move away from us or slow down. We can't assume that any longer. And as you know, Chief, we have issues with impaired drivers. We have issues with distracted drivers. The cell phones, the texting, the increased traffic, the chance of having an impaired driver on the roadway, inattentive drivers, all these things add up to an opportunity for disaster when it when it comes to public safety folks being on the highway. And I dare say that the listeners probably can count on both hands the number of times they were in a near-miss situation, or unfortunately some of our listeners probably today may have been a victim, or at the very least their apparatus or vehicle struck while out on that scene. So this is an increasing problem, and is one that we have focused on. You know, there are a lot of issues involving vehicles in the fire service. The proper driving those vehicles, training people to do that. We're all we're very sympathetic, and we understand a lot of those issues. But we tend to our knitting. We specifically focus on what happens when you set your parking brake and step out on that roadway.
Well, I see a lot of things that talk about how to improve the safety of firefighters while they're actually responding. I don't see quite as much about safety once the parking brake is set and they step out of the vehicle. So this is definitely a niche of safety training and information that I think that firefighters or first responders, police, fire, EMS, when they get on the scene, they're so focused on doing their job and caring for hurt and injured or controlling hazards that it's easy to overlook the amount of hazards that are actually rocketing up and down the highways all around them. What are some of the keys, Steve, to reducing highway incidents that involve responders?
I think the most important factor in this is understanding that we have partners on the roadway. And each of these partners has a role to play in addition to the fire service. Specifically, I'm talking about law enforcement, third service EMS, talking about the towing and recovery industry, which are a big part of this and also suffer a number of losses every year, just as a corollary. You know, if you go down to Chattanooga, Tennessee, to the Towing and Recovery Museum of America, they have a wall of the fallen out there. Now, you know, we think about Emmitsburg and the fire service and how that hallowed ground for the Fallen Firefighters Memorial, but there are numbers of towing and recovery folks that are struck and killed to the point they've had to establish a national memorial for that. So, you know, and then there are DOT workers, people that work for the state or the city or the county that are out there to help us. And in order for us to be successful in protecting responders, we need the cooperation of all those folks, which leads us to a recommendation that we have that comes out of the National Unified Goal for Traffic Incident Management. That's an acronym we use is called the NUG, and the Responder Safety Institute, Emergency Responder Safety Institute, has been out across the country educating fire service leaders and others about the NUG, and we've been successful in getting a fire prevention and safety grant from the FEMA grant program for the last few years, which allowed us to get out and do some of that work. And I'm sure some of the listeners today have probably been participants in our classes when we do that. Now, this NUG has three elements that are very, very important. The first element is responder safety, which trumps just about everything we do. If we're not safe in doing the job, helping others, we can't perform as the public expects us. Number two is the second element. Number two is a safe, quick clearance, and the safe, quick clearance is part of an open roads philosophy. And it involves having an understanding of a chief fire officer, particularly having an understanding of what happens when the highway is closed. And we'll talk about that just in a little more in a second. The third element is interoperable communications, which is not exclusive to highway incidents, but is real important when we cannot communicate with other partners on the highway. And I dare say there are very few places where a fire officer can pick up his radio or her radio and speak with DOT, towing, law enforcement, or maybe a third service EMS service there. So that interoperable communication on the scene is very important. Let me jump back to that open roads philosophy and that safe, quick clearance. And this is probably one of the most difficult concepts that we face in working with fire officers. Most fire departments in the country, based again on state law, have the authority to close the road when they need to do so. And we think that is very, very important to close the road, but again, when it's needed to be closed. When you close a road and a substantial size highway, even a small highway, but a substantial size highway, when you close it, you create a lot of other situations that folks that are not dealing with this issue on a day-to-day basis may not be aware of. Now, I want to say this with a caveat that there are many times in a highway incident where you need to close the highway. And we can all think of those, you know, the hazardous material spill, where we have actual lane blockage where you couldn't drive through if you wanted folks to drive through, where you're in a fire suppression activity, when you have an upset of a large amount of cargo and it's across the road. These are situations where the road needs to be closed, reduced visibility, where we've had a number of serious incidents that we've studied. And NIOSH has studied some of these too, where there's been smoke and fog on the road and the road hadn't been closed. We're not telling chiefs and company officers not to close the road. But what we're saying is to make an informed decision and a windshield size up. And we know our folks can do this because they do it every day on structural responses. We have fire officers and firefighters who can come into the largest building or the smallest single-family dwelling, take a look at that, do a 360, and determine what equipment, manpower, and apparatus they need to deploy to mitigate that situation. Let me give you an example. We would not go into a kitchen fire with a pan of grease with a 2.5-inch blitz line. We would go in and mitigate that with a smaller amount of suppression activity. We want to take that same philosophy that we know that company officers have obtained and have learned on how to size up a structural response to the highway incident. So when there is a possibility of safely allowing traffic to pass, they can do so. Maybe take two lanes on a three-lane road and have one open, or have the shoulder open. Now, why is that important? Well, it's important because you have to know what's going on back upstream when this backup occurs. And this is a concept, again, a lot of times we're focused on the scene as we should be, the extrication activity, the suppression activity, the mitigation of the hazardous material, and we don't think about what might be going on in this queue. And that's a term, that's a DOT term, and one that's used a lot also in Europe, queue meaning a line, this backup of traffic that is taking place. Now think about this from the standpoint of your own family. If your family was back there, you've got people that need to take their medicine. You've got people that need to go to the bathroom. You've got people that need to go get to work, or they're going to be docked on their pay. You know, there are some daycare places that if you don't pick your kid up at the exact time, you're fined $5 a minute for every time you're over. So you've got all these kind of reasons back there, personal reasons. In addition to that, we have point-to-point inventory stocking in plants, where no longer do you have big stockpiles of material. You're waiting for a truck to arrive. And if you're building automobiles and there's a backup 100 miles away and you have to lay off a whole shift of workers, that's a big deal. So economically, there's a reason to do this. Now, those reasons never, never, never trump firefighter safety. That's why I pointed out a little while ago that firefighter safety is always, or responder safety is always the number one. But back in that queue, there are other things happening too. For instance, we might need additional apparatus to respond, additional equipment. It can't get through. It's stuck in the queue. All of a sudden, we have people that aren't familiar with the area that are veering off, taking hazardous cargo through the centers of town, down through developments. And there have been some studies that indicate that secondary incidents, that's incidents that occur after an initial incident on the highway, take the lives of 1 in 8 of our fellow Americans who perish on the highway, the motoring public. Now, that's like 12% of all the fatalities in the country. So certainly there is a good public policy reason to keep traffic moving from a safety standpoint, from the economic standpoint, and from an open roads philosophy. You know, sometimes as first responders, we forget we're family people too. And over on the East Coast, it's not uncommon for folks to save up their cash and load their family, firefighters to load their family in the car and take a big trip down I-95 and over Route 4 in Florida and take their family over to Disney World. And if you've ever been down there, you know you need to check in at a certain time in the afternoon. And most Americans know that when they leave their home and travel for business or pleasure, they can pretty much judge or should be able to judge within an hour or so what time you're going to arrive at your destination. Nothing's worse than being down, you know, 500 miles away from where you're going and sitting for 2 or 3 hours in a traffic backup that could have been dealt with by proper highway incident scene management by all the responders, the police, fire, EMS, and the towing and recovery industry, all working together to make that incident go away. There's some great examples of successful mitigation efforts in which roads have been open hours earlier and responders are off the highway and back in the stations and not exposed to the moving traffic and ready to respond on other incidents just because folks have worked together in a community. Now, how do you do that? I mean, how do you start out on the right track to do that? Well, the first thing you want to do is make sure that you're not exchanging business cards with the other responders on the highway. You need to know who your towers and recovery people are. You've got to have a relationship with your local police department there, whether it be your sheriff's department, municipal police department, or your highway patrol or state police. You need to be talking to those folks, especially ahead of incidents, and that is best done by setting up what we call a local traffic management committee, where the principals meet and talk about issues they've had. Maybe do what they call hot wash or review of the last incident that may not have gone just as well as you thought it would gone. I've always been amazed at us in the fire service how well we do pre-planning the major risks in our community. And we always know where the standpipe connections are. We've been to that building, 100 times before. And the engine company always goes to the right place. And ladder and rescue always shows up. And we always do everything right. Yet we go out to a highway incident, maybe a piece of highway or an intersection where we've been 100 times before. And we never do the exact same thing. We never set up the exact same way. We always do something different. Now, obviously, every incident has its, you adjust for every single incident. But if you're going to the same intersection, if you're working with the same police department, the same towing people, the same EMS squad, and the same DOT people, you need to have that thing pre-planned a little bit so that it'll go a little bit faster. And for every minute of traffic every minute of time that you can have at the scene reduced, that in turn really reduces the number of the length of that backup or that queue where people are going to be waiting impatiently and becoming more and more agitated so they can get by and get on to their business.
That's some great perspective and great advice. One of the things that come to my mind as you were speaking to the concept of the safe, quick clearance and when it's appropriate to close a road and when it's not brings up the topic of there have been some instances well documented and well publicized in the recent past, where there has been conflict on the emergency scene between fire responders and police responders about whether a road should be closed, how it should be closed, where fire apparatus has been staged. Give me some perspective about how these situations should be dealt with if confronted with such a situation. And I realize that's probably, as you'd said, not the best place to be exchanging your business cards at the scene. And then maybe some advice about how to get ahead of this so that you're not having this happen in your community.
Well, we talked about, you know, the increasing number of traffic incidents, and we're exposed more, and that's true. But I would say to you, Chief, that I think our work has helped reduce the number of those instances where there has been a confrontation between law enforcement. It's generally between law enforcement, sometimes with DOT, but mostly it's law enforcement versus the fire service. You know, we always joke that the cop's got the gun. I guess he's going to win. Our slogan is, on the highway, we've got your back, the Emergency Responder Safety Institute. And when you have the head fire official there, which is probably the company officer, and the chief law enforcement person there, which is probably the senior trooper or the sergeant or whoever it might be on the police force, and they're arguing with one another, who's got the backs of the firemen? Who have the backs of the cops out there? These two guys are involved in embroiled in a personal dispute, and nobody's watching out. So obviously there's some dereliction of duty there on both parts, because they now are more interested in getting one-upmanship on this issue than they are in mitigating the entire incident. It's unfortunate. We've seen it happen in many states. It is on the decline. What can we do about that? For the first thing is those local traffic incident management meetings that involve everybody. It's pretty hard to get personally mad at somebody who you've been meeting with and talking to. Now, you'll certainly have a disagreement with the person, but when we've seen these incidents, and we've looked into a number of them in a number of states, in Maryland, in New Jersey, in New York, what we found is that these incidents become very personalized in nature and often result in an arrest of the fire officer. That's a pretty unfortunate situation. And one of the members of our Emergency Responder Safety Institute, a guy by the name of Jim Garcia, who's a very interesting guy, actually, just to digress for a second, he's over in Cambodia now. He's a paramedic in Cambodia helping folks over there. He's established a clinic. He actually was struck in South Carolina, where he worked as a paramedic from a hospital system a number of years ago. And after he was struck, he was actually arrested by the police officer there for parking his ambulance in an inappropriate location on the highway. So we're very familiar with these kind of situations. Again, working with other responders who have the authority to respond and are responding is important. You know, DOT folks, they own the road. Yeah, they own the road. And while police and fire may have the authority to stop and control traffic, that doesn't mean we're going to close the road just because we have the authority to do it. We need to be working together, and that's all part of this national unified goal, which is a major impetus by the Federal Highway Administration and in the Department of Transportation to deal with some of these issues.
Good. Thank you. Again, we're at the Fire Rescue International in Dallas, Texas. This is the Leader's Toolbox on firehouse.com. And our guest is Steve Austin, the project manager for the Emergency Responder Safety Institute. We're going to take a break here so you can receive a message from firehouse.com, and we'll be back in just a moment to continue this discussion on this important issue related to first responder safety.
Radio at firehouse.com. Real issues, real answers, real firefighters.
Okay, welcome back, Leaders Toolbox at Fire Rescue International, with Steve Austin, the project manager for the Emergency Responder Safety Institute. And we're talking about some of the good work the Institute has done and their work to try to improve the safety of first responders, police officers, firefighters, EMS, towing and recovery, DOT employees, and working on the scenes of highway incidents. Before the break, Steve, you had talked a little bit about this queue of cars that get backed up on the scenes of incidents and how that can create problems upstream. When we're, as first responders, when we're on the scenes, you know, we're thinking about our sphere of safety in the area where we're working and trying to protect the lives of the first responders that are in the immediate area where the incident is occurring. But what's some of the things that we might not see that's happening upstream? Some of those human behavior traits of, you know, when mom's late picking up Billy at daycare or somebody who's late for work, what are some of the things that could be happening upstream that could lead to a secondary incident or endanger civilian lives?
Well, the first thing we see, Chief, is a whole bunch of rear-end collisions, and they can be anything from a minor fender bender to something a lot more serious. And we've seen stop traffic, people careening into the back of stop traffic, which brings up a whole issue about advanced warning, and something that we're working on. And that's about how do we notify folks that we're downstream and they should be slowing down. Has to do with the big push to get move over laws, slow down and move over laws in many of the states. So that's probably the most critical situation that occurs back there. Just a straight rear end collision, or somebody veering off the road, coming up quick and hitting somebody in the shoulder and on the shoulder and so forth. I talked a moment ago about what people are doing and try to get firefighters to think about, you know, their families and whether, you know, their loved ones are in a vehicle, their parents, their spouse, their children in a vehicle, and all the things that happen when people are out on the highway, whether they're out there for business or for pleasure. An unfortunate byproduct of the kind of coarsening of our society is road rage. And for some, you know, unknown reason, you know, there are some people in that queue, in that backup upstream, that believe that their mission, where they have to go, is more important than all the other hundreds of vehicles that are stopped around them. And some of these folks do some bizarre things. They either come down the shoulder, they attempt to make a U-turn onto on a limited access highway. I've actually witnessed a bus driver. Now, you would think a bus driver, as a professional driver, wouldn't be involved in a situation like this. But I actually saw a bus driver with a load of senior citizens take it upon himself to make a U-turn through a grassy median in the center of an interstate highway, and that bus sank to its axles, and to the point where it was a hot day, and they had to shut the motors off, the motor on the bus off, and we had to deal with 50 senior citizens in a coach stuck in 80-degree, 85-degree weather with no ventilation in the middle of the highway, all because this bus driver didn't want to wait any longer and thought that he could take reroute his coach by driving across a median and going the opposite direction. So the road rage and the improper driving is a real issue there. We talked about reasons, you know, for as basic as people having to go to the bathroom, but there are also people that need to take medicine. There may be people that in the vehicles that are on their way to a hospital. There may be people that need to take their insulin or what have you. I don't want to be dramatic about this, but or overly dramatic, but I want you to think about the fact that there could be, for every mile, there may be 300 or so more cars in that backup for every single mile. and in the scope of human activity and the thousands of people that could be involved in that, one of those very long backups, there's some real issues there, everything from inconvenience to a serious medical emergency. So those are issues that fire officers confront all the time. If they have to evacuate a large building for a structural response, they're always thinking about the people in that building, how they're going to be sheltered, where they're going to be taken and cared for. They don't turn them out in the hot weather and the cold weather. They figure these things out. But for some reason, we haven't taken that mindset and that training over to the highway scene. So we think about, when we're closing the road, how are we going to reroute? Again, let's go back to that pre-planning issue where we can talk about detour routes. We can talk about having our partners in DOT closing on-ramps and backing people up on the other side and getting them off those limited access highways and around these issues. But you can't do that at the moment you have the incident. That's all got to be pre-planned and worked on well in advance.
Okay. That's good advice. What, well, while you're dispensing the advice, what are some things that can be done by first responders at the scenes of incidents to improve their safety when they're working on a highway?
Well, Chief, as you know, the safety is an issue where responders must take their own responsibility for their personal conduct. And we talk about this all the time in the 16 life-saving initiatives from the National Fallen Firefighters Foundation. We're pleased to be involved with that. I believe it's an initiative number 11, which is the whole vehicle response issue. We do a lot of work with the NFFF on this area. And all of this, all of these initiatives have an era of personal responsibility that firefighters need to be taken. Now, one of those areas is the proper wearing of their PPE. And in case for highway incidents, that's making sure that they're wearing the vests they were issued by their fire department and that they're wearing them right. That means that those vests need to be closed in the front so you have the full 360 vision by the motorists that are approaching there, making sure that you don't step out into moving traffic. Just because you have your turnout gear on your vest does not make you invincible. And I think a lot of times when we're focused on let's get up there and get and make that extrication, we're not as careful as we might be in looking out for moving traffic. We have documented cases on when people tell us, well, the road was closed and responders were struck by vehicles that entered through a cone line or through another way onto that highway and actually struck folks when they were on a, quote, closed road, unquote. So we need to be people to be vigilant. We need firefighters to be wearing their PPE all the time. Firefighters also need some awareness and operation level on how to deal with stuff. NFPA 1001 has two job performance requirements having to do with the highway incident scene safety. One JPR is how to disembark a piece of fire apparatus in the moving traffic. And we know that, and the second one is if the company officer says get traffic and you got to control traffic, what does that mean? Now, we know about those because we put those we submitted those several editions ago to the 1001 committee and they were accepted. And we would say, we don't have any, it's all anecdotal, but we would say there are probably two of the least taught JPRs in the whole basic fire one curriculum. We just don't see them being taught or tested or practiced very often. Yet 1500 talks about having a highway incident management plan in place, and 1001 is it talks about if you're given the command to get traffic, what does that actually mean? And I can't think, Rich, of any other job that a company officer assigns at a scene, assigns a person to do where there has been no training. I mean, getting traffic means something. Go out there and stop the traffic, get the traffic, move the traffic, control the traffic. And if that firefighter has not been received any training in that, that's a recipe for disaster. Now think about this for a second. In order to get an OSHA card to be a flagger on a construction project, you need about a 5 or 6 hour course That's and you get a certificate. It's a tested course, and you get a certificate to do that. And I can tell you that in a construction zone, which is a dangerous area, they're all planned. There are barriers placed out there. There's a cone line, and there's all kinds of things to protect those people that are working at that construction site. But when a fire department arrives first on the scene, sets up, there's nothing there for them. And you have to put up the temporary traffic control, and you have to start controlling the traffic. So it's important that our firefighters know how to do that. We're working on a project right now. It's called Public Safety Flagging. It's a program that we're working with the State Highway Authority in Maryland, part of the Maryland Department of Transportation. And we're going to have a course. There'll be another a course online, we hope, in which folks can actually learn how to do this. And we've been fortunate enough to be able to go out and do some piloting of that, and we're getting good reception in the emergency services for that. Hey, when we talk to our brothers and sisters in law enforcement, believe it or not, even in police academies, there's very little emphasis on the proper way to control traffic. And we think that's important, and we think having people trained to do that can save their lives and save the lives of their fellow responders.
Well, I can attest firsthand that I have never formally been trained how to do traffic control, and throughout my career, that has been my assignment on numerous occasions, to be the one who tries to either stop or reroute traffic around incidents. And it can be challenging, and it can be scary, because people don't always see you. They don't always want to pay attention to you. They want to go through the accident scene regardless of what you tell them. And there's a science behind traffic management and traffic movement, and a class like that would be very beneficial. And we'll look forward to that being made available to the fire service. And you say it's going to be an online class, so there's little excuse for someone to say they don't have the time to be able to learn the proper way in which to manage traffic and manage an incident scene on the highway. What are some of the future plans for the Institute toward improving responder safety?
Well, we always have a two or three things in the hopper at any given time, Chief, because this is an evolving issue. For those listeners who have never looked at our website, respondersafety.com, you can see some of those programs that we have up and running already, and some of the future stuff we're doing. I would encourage everybody to go to respondersafety.com and take a look at it. That is a site that is dedicated solely for this issue. And I should say that we've had a long relationship with firehouse.com, who helped us initially get this site off the ground, and have been we still have a very, very good working relationship, share news with Firehouse on the .com side, back and forth between Responder Safety and .com and Firehouse. And matter of fact, you asked about the future. We're getting ready to do a pretty in-depth webinar. Our director of training, Jack Sullivan, from Richmond, Virginia, who is a safety professional and a fire service guy, who has done these before. It's met with a lot of kudos from listeners. We're getting ready to do one of those in the very near future. ResponderSafety.com also tracks. We're the only place in the country that you can find this. We track all of the struck-bys in the country that happen every day, and we generally find a couple a day. Now, you think about that. That's the ones that we find on the web, and we find in news feeds and so forth. We put them up. We certainly have to do in-depth work when there's line-of-duty death on the highway, and we have those listed, along with a lot of other material, training material, news, the move over laws, and all that kind of stuff. So all that's out there. Probably the most exciting project that we have now that we're looking at is we've been fortunate to just receive notice that we're going to receive another fire prevention and safety grant from FEMA, from the competitive system. And there is a, and we're going to be developing an essentials manual with our partners down at Fire Service Publications at OSU. Now, you talked to Rich a little while ago about, you know, some of the training issues, and there's this document out there that's pretty unknown to the fire service, but very, very well known to the transportation industry, and that's called the Manual for Uniform Traffic Control Devices. This manual is, it once was thought to be nothing but a manual that was used by DOTs and others that constructed, maintained, and operated highways. But over the years, a chapter in this manual has been developed called Chapter 6I. And Chapter 6I deals with temporary traffic control and who is responsible. And we're seeing more and more emphasis, unfortunately, some of it in the litigation area, when these accidents do happen, with fire service folks being unaware of exactly what 6I does. And 6I is a federal regulation. This Manual for Uniform Traffic Control Devices is a federal manual published by the Department of Transportation, by the Federal Highway Administration. It's been around a long time. It got started, like a lot of these manuals, with a couple simple ideas. Way back when, it decided, you know, where the colors of the stop, what the colors of the stoplights are going to be, and making sure the red was on the top, the yellow was in the middle, and the green was on the bottom. And it also then moved into the shape of stop signs and the colors. And now, it deals with temporary traffic control in the Chapter 6I. This thing is about as thick as the New York City telephone directory. However, the part that affects the fire service is Chapter 6I. We're going to take Chapter 6I, and we're going to make an essentials manual out of that with OSU. We're going to get some materials in that essentials manual that curriculum development people and firefighters and trainers can use to train people how to deal with the requirements of Chapter 6I, which are basically the safety requirements that fire departments need to know when they get out on the highway in the first 15 to 30 to 40 minutes of an incident. After that, it really becomes a responsibility, assuming that the folks are there, for DOT and law enforcement to pick that up. But how many times have our listeners responded to an incident where for a long period of time, and maybe the entire incident, they were the only responders? So we need to get our folks trained so they can be in compliance with 6I, but not just to be in compliant and avoid litigation, but to keep their responders safer. Because as I mentioned earlier as we talked today, that the number one goal here is to make sure that our responders go home after every run, and we don't leave anybody in the hospital or worse.
Well, that certainly sounds like a couple of very aggressive and worthwhile projects on in the future coming up here. I want to back up to the webinar and ask you what the time frame is as far as when you think the webinar is going to be available, and then by what format could a listener tune into the webinar? Where would they go to get that?
That'll be well. Thanks for asking that for that softball, Rich. That'll be well publicized on firehouse.com. You're going to hear a lot about that. You'll be able to log right on at firehouse.com. My understanding is that there'll be no charge for that. The last time we did that, and of course, these are saved as for later use as a podcast, where even a larger number of people look at them after the initial webinar. But the last time we did this, I think we had between 500,000 people initially get involved. So stay tuned. Stay looking at at firehouse.com. There'll certainly be things on respondersafety.com about that. And by the way, we do have a newsletter on respondersafety.com. Go to the page and sign it up. And don't be afraid to put your name and your email addresses. That's a proprietary list. We do not sell the list. We do not give it away to anyone else. And we only use that for two reasons. We will send you what we call a breaking news alert when there has been a responder who's lost his or her life on the highway, or we have new training material available. Otherwise, you're not going to hear from us. So don't think, oh gosh, I don't need to be on there another newsletter and get another, add to my inbox, build my inbox up. You won't hear from us that often, but when you do hear from us, it'll be something important. And obviously, well in advance, you'll hear from us when the webinar is scheduled. We're doing some interesting things. We're doing some field testing of equipment. We've been doing some work with helmets for people that just control traffic. That's generally in the East Coast, 15 states that have fire police operations where fire departments have their own traffic control operations. When you think about that, in the area that I live in Delaware, there are more fire policemen than there are members of the Delaware State Police. And they're an intricate part of the traffic control operations. But, there are full career departments that have auxiliary folks that come out and do nothing but traffic control for them. Chief Goldfeder, for instance, in Loveland Sims, Ohio, has a full career department there, but they do have an emergency service corps of citizens that control traffic for them and have their own traffic units. And we've been doing a lot of work with traffic units. We're looking at light colors. We were the folks behind the public safety vest that everybody's wearing. We were out in front of that issue. Made the plea for the International Safety Equipment Association to adopt the ANSI 207 public safety vest standard. Very much worked very closely with the 1901 committee in developing the striping on the rear of a fire apparatus. On our webpage now, we offer a number of solutions for those folks that want to retrofit older apparatus 2008 and backwards to get it a little more safer on the highway, to make it maybe look like make it identical or just look like the new 1901 standard. So there's a lot happening in that that area, and we're proud to be a player in just about all of that stuff.
Good. Another thing you had mentioned, Steve, was the essentials manual for addressing highway safety through fire safety or fire service publications at OSU. When might our listeners see that actually hit the websites and bookstores?
Well, we think that's going to be we know that we need to do that in about a year to 18 months, because that's the life of a fire grant. The FEMA really wants you to step that up and get that work going. We just were awarded that grant about a week or so ago, and we're working on that. We would think that by late 2010 or 2011, we'll have that out. We haven't got into the details with our friends down at Fire Service Publication. We're going to be working very close with Mike Weeder down there and Chris Neal and others on this. Whether this will go through the regular IFSTA validation route, or whether we'll just publish this as another publication for Fire Service Publication, we haven't gotten that far. But we can tell you one thing, that this is going to be done by firefighters for firefighters, and it'll be directed to the fire service, and it'll have the same quality and the same feel as any of those wonderful IFSTA manuals that now have been around for three quarters of a century.
Okay, good. So the grant just awarded, so people be patient. It's going to take a little bit of time for the group that are assembled to create this manual to get it to a product that's going to be able to be put out onto the street for general use.
Yeah, I think that may be the ultimate piece for us for the future. In the near term, we've got a couple other exciting projects that we're working on. We talked about that first 15 minutes, and we are working diligently to deal with that issue, and that's going to be focused on apparatus and vehicle drivers in that first 15 minutes, about how to go in there, do that windshield size up, and get that apparatus and equipment in the right location to start with, so we don't have to move that around. We just lost a firefighter a few weeks ago when a piece of apparatus had to be moved at the scene. And this was a backing accident that a firefighter fell between the wheels. Now, we're not sure why the firefighter fell yet. He may have fallen because he had a cardiac event. but his injuries that he received were inconsistent with life. So I guess it doesn't really make any difference. He was underneath the wheel, whether he underneath the rear wheels. And that was a backing accident that took place at the scene to let an ambulance out. Now, we don't know a whole lot about that incident yet, but we do know this, that we're better off not having to move our engines and so forth at an incident scene. We'd like to see them placed and properly positioned in a blocking mode to best deal with the situation without having to move them again. So we're working on that project. The second project is the one we're working with Chief Assistant Chief Ron Moore in McKinney, Texas, who is our chief our chief of training, our chief instructor. Ronnie has been concerned for a number of years about rural highway incident management. We often think this is these incidents are all involving limited access interstate grade highways. They are not. We see a substantial number of these on two-lane roadways, and those are listeners that routinely do tanker shuttles. Often find themselves in a very perplexing situation on a two-lane road. Either they're cutting off whole sections of their community for people that need to do what they need to do, just as those people backed up on Interstate Highway. Rural people have the same issues. And also, it's a very dangerous situation where you may be taking a bridge out and you're doing a drafting operation and having to let traffic go by. So we're putting together a very, very nice package that's called Highway Incident Management on Rural Roads. And we expect that to be out probably in the next 6 months or so, along with the other program. So between now and the time that the listeners will be looking for that new Essentials Manual, we're going to have some other stuff up. Now, the best way to find out about that is to keep looking at respondersafety.com. A lot of our product is downloadable, and a whole lot of it is we'll ship it to you for free. There's no cost for any of this stuff. We've been able to do this without having to charge anyone. And I should say too that some folks wonder how we do all this. Well, we have a relationship with the National Fallen Firefighters Foundation. We talked a little bit a while ago about the fact that we exchange content with them. We work with them on the 16 Life-Saving Initiative, but in a much, much more basic relationship with them, they actually handle our fulfillment center for our product. When you order product from respondersafety.com, that goes to the National Fallen Firefighters Foundation office, and their staff package that and get that out to you in the mail. So we're real pleased with with having that relationship at all levels with the NFFF, and want to continue with that. So lots of things are going on in this world and in this highway incident safety world. And until we get a better handle on what's happening out there on the roadways and we start to see a decrease in some of these struck-by incidents, well, then we'll be able to lighten up a little bit. But right now, we're going to continue to move forward as we have in the last 11 years in making that highway as safe as we possibly can for all emergency responders.
Well, Steve, it's been an outstanding podcast. I have learned so much about responder safety by going to your website and being part of your newsletter. And the opportunity to sit down and talk with you for the benefit of our listeners has been a real treat for me. Steve Austin, again, is the project manager for Emergency Responder Safety Institute. They are a committee of the Cumberland Valley Volunteer Firemen's Association. I want to make sure that I give credit to the Cumberland Valley Volunteer Firemen's Association, their website, cvvfa.org, and we'll put a link on that to the bottom of the podcast player page, and www.respondersafety.com. It's visionary leadership like this that creates change in the fire service and helps all of us be safer. From Dallas, Texas, at the Fire Rescue International Leaders Toolbox, Steve, I'd like to thank you for being my guest today.
Glad to be here with you, Chief.
Okay, for listeners, if you have any feedback or questions, you can reach us at podcasts@firehouse.com, and there's always a link to that at the bottom of the player page as well. Thank you for joining us, and we'll see you at the next episode.
If you have a comment on this program, drop us a line at radio@firehouse.com. Thanks for listening, and stay tuned to firehouse.com for more broadcasts like these, or visit our website at www.firehouse.com/radio.